No further ado, we'll turn to Mr. Hitchens.
Shall I not be erect? No, all right, I'll be seated. Shalom. There must be something very persuasive about those who put this meeting together, because they maybe break two of my usual rules. One is not to enter a house of worship without wearing a vast necklace of garlic around my neck. And the other is to do no work, no labor of any kind on the International Day of the Working Class, May Day. So you maybe break two for a start. But hey, that's what commandments are for. There's always a danger of hucksterism if you have a provocative subtitle to a book you may write, such as the subtitle of my own most recent book, which says, after announcing that God is not great, that it's about how religion poisons everything. And people have asked me, you mean everything, as in chess, as in male sexuality, whatever the topic might be. The answer I give is, in a sense, yes, because religion, the religious cult, attacks us in our deepest integrity and morality. It says of us what it accuses atheists of saying, that we are nothing really but animals, fearful, naked, bare-forked creatures who, without divine permission, without the permission, in other words, of a supernatural dictatorship, a celestial North Korea, wouldn't know right from wrong, wouldn't be able to make a moral stand or announce a moral difference or do the right thing or elect to recommend that the right thing be done. Without supernatural guidance, we wouldn't know how to do it. In other words, it takes away our most basic essential integrity, or attempts to do so. In other words, yes, there's nothing that doesn't poison or doesn't threaten to poison. So that would be my opening proposition. I have evolved two brief challenges based on this argument, which is, in my view, the core argument of the religious and the believers. And I'll just briefly share them with you. I've tried this now in print, in person, in public, on the radio, on the television, and in innumerable other forums, and I haven't yet had a decent answer, but maybe tonight will be the night I am unhorsed. You have to propose a right action committed, or a morally right statement made by a believer that could not have been made or performed or uttered by a non-believer. That's all you have to do. No one's been able to do it yet, but you are welcome to try, and if you succeed, then I'll tell you what the prize is, but not before. And then there's a corollary challenge, which is this: can you imagine or can you think of a wicked action undertaken or a wicked statement made by a believer because of their belief that would not be attributable to an unbeliever? And you've already thought of one of those, haven't you? And before you're much older, you've thought of another wicked thing that has been done precisely and only because of faith, or an awful statement made. I'm not even going to specify. You've already thought of one. Everyone can do that. No one has any difficulty. While you ponder that, I feel I should add that the gravamen of the case against religion also depends upon its being our first, and that's to its credit, but for that reason also our worst attempt at an explanation of our lives, our ethics, our being, our nature. Religion is what we came up with as a matter of philosophy, as a matter of climatology, as a matter of seismology, as a matter of cosmology, as a matter of philosophy, all of these things when we didn't know very much, when we were in our fearful infancy, when we didn't know that we lived on a cooling planet with cracks in its crust that would lead to catastrophic events, when we did not know that diseases were spread by germs rather than by devils or by demons, when we didn't know that our planet was spherical, when we didn't know that it revolved around other heavenly bodies. It comes from the time we knew nothing. It's our first and therefore our worst explanation, and it burdens us. It burdens us to this day with that terrible legacy, with that heritage of ignorance and fear and cruelty and stupidity that is so much celebrated in the holy books that have become themselves such a burden and such a threat in our lives today. And this still shows. To elaborate a little on the challenge I just made about the relationship between religion and immorality, wickedness, evil behavior, I think you will find that the genital mutilation community is almost entirely religious, that the suicide murder community is almost entirely religious, that the decision to teach students stultifying nonsense about creationism instead of evolution as the in the biology lesson is entirely a theocratic community, and that though the secular and atheist communities are not free from blemish or wickedness of their own, that crimes that occur in all cultures, such as ethnic cleansing, for example, or virulent forms of nationalism and racism, find that religion is a tremendous force multiplier when they do break out, a great intensifier of such things. And again, I won't, because I only have the residue of my 7 minutes, I won't bore you with giving the examples. I know I only have one. I notice. I'll close then and simply say that in order to believe any of this, you have to believe the following, that our species, 75,000 years old in archaeological terms, that's when the first traces show up, 100,000 years old for sure, Francis Collins and Richard Dawkins all agree on that, it's not less than 100, could be as many as 200,000 or quarter of a million years old, you have to believe to be religious now, that for the first, if we give it 100 as the round figure, for the first 95,000 years or so, people are born, die, probably having lived about 20, 25 years. Most of their children will die younger than that, in horrible ways, probably of their teeth or of diseases they can't give a name to. But the struggle goes on, painful, agonizing, and full of fear, and full of panic, and ignorance, and superstition, and disease, but slow progress is made, perhaps, and then relapses as people fight over women, fight over territory, fight over gain, fight just in order to fight. And heaven watches this. Paradise watches this. The Creator watches this for 95,000 years with folded arms. And after about 5,000 years, says, it's time to intervene. Preferably by human sacrifice methods, and only in the most backward and primitive and fearful parts of the Middle East. And that will constitute revelation, and that is going to be the participation of God in human affairs. If you believe that, then you are willing, ladies and gentlemen, to believe absolutely anything, but you believe something that suggests that your Creator is someone both bungling and incompetent, and at the very, very least, callous, inhumanly cold and indifferent, and at the worst, actively wicked. And I say that human progress doesn't proceed like that, that all the indices of human progress can be measured precisely by the better tradition by which we have emancipated ourselves from the belief in a totalitarian boss, and that the bulk of that work remains ahead of us, and some of it can be done even this evening. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for having me, and I'm thrilled to be a part of this panel. I have had both of these men on my radio show, and I enjoy dialoguing with them a great deal, and I will tonight. I'm debating whether it's moral to react to anything that Christopher said, since he went first and he had nothing to react to what we said, so I will choose the easy way out and both react to what he said and offer some other thoughts. And I will react immediately in this way. He said, and if I jotted it down quickly enough, if you are prepared to believe that, namely that there is a good God who governs the universe, created human beings, and so on, then you are prepared to believe absolutely anything. In reality, what I have found in my life is that the people who are most prepared to believe anything idiotic are the secular. In the United States of America and Western Europe, you are far more likely to believe nonsense if you are a secular human than if you are a religious Jew or Christian. The nonsense that religious Jews or Christians may believe in, and even assuming it is nonsense, is quite constricted to a handful of theological premises. But if I had to bet my entire, well, I was going to say my house mortgage, but it's right now, given the housing crisis, that there wouldn't be much to bet. But in any event, if I would have to bet everything that I have on the following proposition, that if you took 1,000 American college students who were regular church attenders and 1,000 completely secular college students from the same socioeconomic backgrounds and asked them a whole host of questions, it is no doubt in my mind, and no doubt in my mind, that Christopher Hitchens would find that the answers given by the ones who went to church were far more rational. For example, when I went to Columbia University, a bastion of secular thought, I was told as a given that men and women were basically the same. You had to be secular and intellectual to believe such drivel. Religious people knew this was nonsense. Today, I believe that the hysteria over global warming is indeed hysteria. You are far more likely to believe that hysteria if you are secular than if you are religious. G.K. Chesterton was entirely right, entirely, that when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. The track record of the secular world's belief in idiocy overwhelms the Judeo-Christian world's beliefs in idiocy. And that's the only world that I am defending tonight, and specifically the Jewish one, the Jewish conception of God, but I will take the Judeo-Christian, Western European, and American right now as my model for a person who is far more likely to believe rationally about life and morally about life. I was also taught at Columbia University that the United States and the Soviet Union were morally equivalent. Religious people didn't believe that, by and large. The secular believed that. As for the track record of morality, which we'll get to later, the secular make most religious people look like Boy Scouts. The record of secular, of atheistic murder, torture, mass murder, and mass torture dwarfs all the religions in all of history combined. And that's in only 100 years of communism and Nazism. So I don't know where he got that from. If his issue is who's more likely to have rational conclusions about life, he has no good neighbors. He is stuck with a world that when it drops God, it drops wisdom. There are good people who are atheists and there are twits who are religious, but there is no wisdom in the atheist and secular worlds, none. That is why we live in the age of stupidity in America today. The age that does believe that if you give a girl trucks, she will grow up to play with trucks. And if you give a boy dolls, he will grow up to play with dolls. Only the secular believe that. The religious scratch their heads how people could believe such nonsense. Now, as to the larger issue of God's existence. To be an atheist is to believe that everything came from nothing. Since I cannot prove God, and he cannot disprove God, and he cannot prove how anything came about, we now enter the world of only common sense and likelihood. On the issue of common sense and likelihood, I simply ask you if you believe that it is more likely that everything, and I mean everything, came about on its own. That is what Christopher Hitchens and all atheists believe. It all came about on its own. But nothing physical comes from nothing. Nothing does. So it is a leap of faith that absolutely dwarfs my leap of faith, and I acknowledge it's a leap of faith that there is a good God who governs the universe. I fully do. I accept Rabbi Milton Steinberg's great, great statement, which I will offer as in just a nutshell form. I will paraphrase. The believer in God has to account for one thing, the existence of unjust suffering. The atheist, however, has to account for the existence of everything else. That is so powerful to me as to be inherently persuasive. I fully acknowledge the weakness in the religious belief. I fully acknowledge it. that if I believe there is a God, I have to somehow deal with children with cancer and tsunamis and so on. I fully, and every religious person acknowledges that difficulty, or every thinking religious person. But the atheist has to account for everything else. We went from nothing to Bach is a belief that he has. That's rational. We're the ones who make strange, irrational leaps of faith, not the atheist. Yes, we went from absolutely nothing, or even for that matter, from a rock to Beethoven's Ninth on its own. Okay? If you believe that, I conclude, then you are absolutely prepared to believe anything.
Jody mentioned in the introduction my past as a little bit of a troublemaker in my college days. I remember we used to tell the deans that taking on our conservative campus newspaper was a bit like wrestling with a pig. Not only did it get everyone dirty, but the pig liked it. Now, the three of us on this podium, I believe we have a couple of things in common. First of all, I think we are all of, for all our differences, we are of one mind on the subject of Islamic radicalism and terrorism. Since we all are relatively open-minded, we believe in keeping channels of open communication with the Islamic radicals, and this open communication, I think, should take the form of live ammunition. Now, I believe in a sense it is not inaccurate to say also that all three of us are in a certain way agnostics. And what I mean by that is that there is a difference between religious belief and rational knowledge. I would say, for example, that I believe in God, but I wouldn't say I believe in my brother. I know the guy. So you believe when you don't know. In that sense, we are all in a field of open inquiry using the same tools. Inference to the best explanation, history, philosophy, science, and so on. Christopher Hitchens began by posing what is to me a very striking question. He said, isn't it odd that you've got 100,000 years of uneventful history, and then suddenly God appears to jump in the picture? And suddenly, if you will, the religious story gets going. I would submit that even if you took God out of the picture completely, the puzzle remains. If we've been on this planet for 100,000 years as Darwinian primates, having pretty much the same brains that we have now, why is it the case that for 95,000 of those years, man accomplished virtually nothing? Not having invented a wheel, not having come up with a cave painting even, and then suddenly, 5,000 years ago, history gets started. History gets started in a lot of different places. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, everybody starts inventing stuff. It does appear as if some sort of a transcendent breath may have grabbed a couple of those Darwinian primates and breathed something we might call a soul into them. This would explain things a lot better, wouldn't it? Now, I'd like to say a little bit about myself. I'd like to say a little bit about God. I'd like to say a little bit about Christianity. I'd like to say a little bit about Jesus. In my own case, I'm a little bit of an oddity. I come from Bombay, India. My family is from a part of India called Goa. I was born Christian. The reason for this is the Portuguese missionaries dropped in on us a few hundred years ago, and they came with a Bible in one hand and a bayonet in the other. They were extremely persuasive. And yet, so I was raised Christian. But This is a point I want to make about the nature of religious belief. A lot of us learn our Christianity, our Judaism, when we are very young. We learn a Christianity adapted to our young mind when we are 5 or 7 or 8 years old. This is what I call crayon Christianity. It's a simplified idea of God as a big man with a Santa Claus beard and so on. Now, this is the Christianity we take to college, where we meet the younger versions of Christopher Hitchens in the form of graduate students, sometimes young professors, and they pelt your religious belief with skepticism. How can you believe this? Miracles, isn't that ridiculous in an age of science and so on? So many of us find that we can't answer those objections at a young age, and we find ourselves pulling away from our faith, from our religious convictions. This is not because those objections cannot be answered. We simply don't know the answers at that point in life. So in some senses, it is only in adult life that I have thought about those same questions. And come to a certain adult or mature theism, very different from the beliefs I held when I was 8. And this theism, I think Dennis and I in some ways want to show, can withstand the skeptical assault and meet it on its own ground. I want to say in the short time I have left, I've got to adopt the motto here that King Henry VIII used with one of his wives. He said, "I shouldn't keep you too long." So I want to make one, if I may, scientific argument for God's existence. In recent decades, leading scientists have asked a very interesting question. The universe as we know it operates according to some very fixed numerical values. I'm not talking about our planet, the universe as a whole. The gravitational force is so strong, the electromagnetic force is so strong, the strong nuclear force, the so-called electroweak force, and so on and so on. One physicist, Lee Smolin, describes it as God is sitting at a desk with 100 different dials. Every dial set to a very definite and precise number. So the scientists ask this question: what if we were to alter the dials a little bit, fool with them, not a whole lot? What would happen? Stephen Hawking discusses this question in A Brief History of Time, and he notes that if you touch one of the dials and move it, he's talking about the rate of expansion of the universe, move it not 10%, not 1%, but one part in 100,000,000,000,000,000, we would have no universe, we would have no life. The entire universe needs to be as big as it is and as old as it is and to have precisely the values that it does, or else we would not be having this conversation. The whole universe appears to be a giant conspiracy to produce, well, us. This argument has put modern atheism completely on the defensive, and I also want to say it is an argument immune to Darwinian attack. So I'm delighted to be here and look forward to a skeptical exchange on these issues. I think at the end of the day, we're all going to be saying, thank God for religion, and specifically, thank God for Christianity. Thank you.
Thank you, Dinesh. Each of our speakers will now each take 8 minutes to respond to the other two gentlemen. We'll begin again with Mr. Hitchens.
Wait, I'm so sorry. It says here I have 4 minutes to cross-examine.
Four for each of us.
Well, you have four for each, so you can use them however you like. You can do four. You can spend six on Dinesh.
If I'm supposed to cross-examine, I should do that rather than rebut. Don't think I've run out of things to say.
No.
I'm just recovering from the amount of applause for Christianity I just heard from the pews. Perhaps it was just making nice. I don't know. Why don't I do a bit of cross-examination and see how it goes? Someone will have to be a timekeeper.
Right here.
And I'm told my first is to Dennis. And I think I'll begin by asking him if he would care to specify for me the secular roots of anti-Semitism and fascism, the founding movement of totalitarianism. I'm taking you up on your point about secular totalitarianism being as bad as religious.
Given that there was
the
no...
The original totalitarian movement, the movement that invented the term in the 20th century, fascism, is, if you look at any history, I'll just make this observation, any history of the mid-20th century, take out the word fascism, put in the Catholic right wing, nothing changes, right? Whether it's the history of Spain or Croatia or Hungary. I want to know where the secular roots of anti-Semitism and fascism are, in your opinion.
I'd rather
have evidence than opinion.
Okay.
For a change.
I'm sorry, what was that? I didn't hear the last sentence before that. All right, doesn't matter. The question is not fully honest, and not that you're being dishonest, and I'm very careful
because I have
great respect for so much of what you say.
Thank you.
But I'll tell you why it's not an honest question. It's because it's somewhat of a non sequitur. There was no secularism until the philosophes and until the 18th century in Western Europe. So to ask what are the secular roots of a hatred that goes back 3,000 years is to ask what it's like asking what are the secular roots what are the religious roots of Henry Ford's Model T. I mean, one has nothing to do with the other. However, today...
You did say that this was a secular movement.
I did say what was a secular
movement. You said that fascism and Nazism were secular.
Yes, they are indeed. I said communism and Nazism. I was trying to get you to
acknowledge the utter falsity of what you'd said.
There's a problem with these sounds here.
I also in getting you to say that it is utterly false. The origins of the organizing principle of that movement, Jew-hating, are not secular.
They are
in the religion that half the people in this room just applaud.
Well, then give me the secular roots of the Ten Commandments. It's just as silly a question. There is no secular roots when there is no secularism. But today in America, almost all the anti-Semitism comes from the secular left. So it's a very poor argument on your where
you
there
will.
Is religion in
I
America and there is secularism. The anti-Semitism is overwhelmingly like at UC Irvine next week from the secular left.
Now I'm just very sorry to have to tell you that I think that now you may have perhaps exhausted the extreme tolerance for other people's religions that as the Catholic anti-Semitism. But I've just been specifying in this room. Anyone who doesn't know where anti-Semitism is being pumped out in the modern world, in this room, I'd be very surprised. I mean, if it isn't pretty well understood that the revival of the protocols of the Elders of Zion comes from the Hamas website.
Yes, of course it does.
Comes from another
monotheism. They're not in the United States.
Another
they're in
monotheism
the Middle East.
That correctly claims kinship with Christianity and Judaism. It's the origins of anti-Semitism. Are entirely in other monotheisms. I mean, if anyone doesn't know...
Yes, they are. They are.
A single text of the secular left that licenses anti-Semitism, I should be very surprised. And I challenge you to do so.
Well, sure, I'll be
but
happy.
But I would invite you to stop exculpating.
At the very least,
stop making excuses for the actual practitioners of anti-Semitism, the Catholic and Islamic right wing.
My book on anti-Semitism is available, and it has an entire chapter on the Christian roots and the Muslim roots of anti-Semitism.
Well, why did you mention that instead of slandering secularists who are not guilty of this charge?
Why did I mention what? It's terrible.
Why did you not mention the religious roots of this filthy prejudice instead of slandering secularists who aren't guilty of it? Why waste your time and hours? First of all,
I didn't even mention anti-Semitism. You did. So why you can't ask me why I didn't mention what you're raising.
I appeal to you, ladies and gentlemen. That's a very evasive series of answers. Very disappointing performance. I think 4 minutes cross-examination. Now, for Dinesh, do I get to go to Dinesh now?
Please,
Dinesh will perhaps not be so evasive when I ask him. He kept saying he was a Christian. What he meant to say was he was a Roman Catholic. There are lots of ways of being Christian. For example, to take the nonsensical statements made by Mr. Prager earlier about, for example, gender equality or global warming. These are the sort of things you get from Quakers and Unitarians and Methodists and Anglicans, as much as you do from secularists. There are many, many ways of being Christian, but the Pope says there's only one true way of being one. Ratzinger says there's only one true church, only one church that's divinely inspired, that has real authority, and it's the Roman Catholic Church. Is your view also the view of His Holiness?
I'm not sure. I'll be honest with you. I think you're jumping a little bit here into describing my views, which I've written about quite openly. I certainly am raised Catholic. I've drawn in my work on the intellectual tradition. On the other hand, I'm married to an evangelical Christian, and in my work and in my life, I try to combine elements of the Catholic intellectual tradition with some of the experiential, faith-based relationship with God elements that I draw from evangelical Christianity. So quite openly, I identify myself with what C.S. Lewis called mere Christianity. That's not an evasion. That's where I am.
Okay, but you'll admit that for me, I mean, who does say to anyone who asks exactly what he thinks, and when I say I'm an atheist, you can pretty much tell what I'm going to say and what I'm going to stand by. It's disappointing every time I ask a religious person to find that they're shopping from some clerical cafeteria. I like this bit, I don't like that bit. To be a Roman Catholic is supposed to mean that you say that all other forms of religion are false.
I don't think it's worth
Holy Mother Church actually says. I'm saying this for this reason. There's a lot of soft ecumenicism in the air tonight, and there's a lot of soft ecumenicism in the audience tonight. I just feel a few tough distinctions are worth making. People who really take their church seriously, particularly Holy Mother Church, say, it's a pity. You're wasting your time. Your religion is worthless to you. It's not going to get you to heaven. It's not going to redeem you. It's not going to save you. There's only one way of doing that. Now, that surely has to be counted also as among the beliefs that we're discussing.
Well, first of all,
wouldn't you say yes to that?
Well, you made a number of statements. Look, it is in some senses true that all religions, and by the way, this is no less true of atheism or secularism, claim an exclusive claim to truth. If atheism is true, no religion can possibly be true.
That's quite right.
So atheism in that sense is just as parochial in asserting the falsity of every competing faith. Second, Christianity is probably the only religion that declares another religion to be completely true, and that is Judaism. Christianity is built, you might say, on the foundation of Judaism and intends to incorporate it, unedited, the whole thing. Third, even within Catholicism, there is something that actually ranks higher than the Pope and higher than all the encyclicals, and that is the inner voice of conscience. This is asserted in numerous ways, but it is a doctrinal teaching that conscience, the little referee, what Adam Smith called the impartial spectator inside of us, that is the ultimate authority.
Not wanting to be accused of soft moderating, we need to pass the conversation on to Mr. Prager, please.
All right.
I'm sorry.
It would be better to do rebuttals, wouldn't it?
It would.
Could you speak a bit louder?
Let's try this and then we'll switch.
Wouldn't rebuttals have been a lot better?
Back and forth.
Okay.
Well, I think we should keep the format.
Yeah.
I think keep the format now, and we can regroup after.
Yeah, then we can do it. I agree that just allowing rebuttals for a longer time afterwards rather than cross-examination.
Let's do this, and then next round we'll play
with. Yes, it reminds me too much of lawyers in any event than I.
or congressional hearings.
Yes. Is it my turn? All right, so Christopher, I just have a number of questions that would interest me to get your answer to. I fully acknowledge, and so did Dinesh D'Souza at the very outset, that every thinking believer has doubts. Do you ever doubt your atheism?
Well, the practice, the atheist, secularist, materialist practice, is based on doubt.
No, you're not answering my question. Do you ever doubt atheism? I sometimes doubt God's existence. Do you ever doubt God's non-existence?
No.
Okay. That is exactly a perfect example.
I try.
It is a perfect...
I try, but I can't succeed. I do my best. I give it a try, but,
okay.
It's not possible to...
I know. Look, I appreciate your honesty because...
I think I'm here myself because of the laws of biology and not because of a divine plan. I just haven't got the arrogance to claim that I'm here because God has a plan for me.
On the contrary, you have much more arrogance because your certitude is greater than ours. We have self-doubt, you do not. You heard that, ladies and gentlemen.
You did not make me concede any such thing. You're so glib.
No, you said you...
You're so glib, you squeak.
I'm sorry. I asked you, do you ever doubt...
I didn't concede anything of the sort.
All right.
I said I try,
yes,
but I can't.
But, right.
I can't.
So I don't care whether you try or not. The fact is that you never doubt your atheism. We doubt our religiosity.
I cannot come up with...
There is a far more inquiring mind among the thoughtful religious than among, and I will include you, the thoughtful atheists. You are far more dogmatic than we are.
I can't find any merit in, since you're asking me again, I can find no merit in any theistic explanation of my presence here or yours.
Yes, that's a separate question.
I have tried.
Whether you I understand. Whether you find merit or not.
I owe you my best reply.
Okay, so we answered that question. We acknowledge doubts. You acknowledge no doubts. Fine,
no,
fair
no,
enough. Next
no,
question.
No, that's not what I said.
That is what you said. It's on tape
no,
and video.
It is not what I said.
It is what you said.
No,
you said you try, but you fail.
No, no, you're
you
being
said
boring
it four
as
times
well as glib. You're being boring as well as glib. And dishonest, too.
Well, all right. Look, people,
look to your,
you
look
will
to your
all
immortal,
purchase
look
the CD,
immortal,
and
look
you will.
Your immortal
you,
soul.
Okay. You
look
said
to your
you
soul.
Said you don't doubt your atheism. All right, we'll leave that point. If you said you did, well, the audience will judge. Next,
statement that something is doubtless is not a statement of dogma. Okay, I don't doubt the rotundity
okay.
of
it's
the globe.
It's a dogmatic. It's a dogmatic.
I don't
outlook.
Doubt it.
Right. Okay. We acknowledge more intellectual doubts. It's all I wanted to say because there is an all pervasive. Outlook today that it is the atheist who is the open-minded and it is the religious believer who is the closed-minded, and you just heard an example, in my opinion, if you reject it, you reject it, but in my opinion, of a greater open-mindedness to self-doubt and self-inquiry among most religious people than among the atheists.
I don't doubt the theory of natural selection either.
Okay, fine. That's,
I don't
doubt it. That's all right, fine. I understand.
Sorry.
I don't doubt that the sun rises in the east. So you
very
have
good.
The same
now,
certitude
now,
about
finally,
that. Now we're finally nothing.
Thinking.
Okay. Now, you asked about can we come up with any good actions that were done because of religion that wouldn't be done by secularists, and if one did, you would give them a prize to be announced later. I will ask for that prize in a moment. And you said, on the other hand, there are evil actions that can only be fostered by religion. I mean, that's beneath you. It's not intellectual. There are evils that have been committed that are horrific by both secularists. I don't know if Gulag came up and the communists came up and Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung in North Korea, who were avowed atheists, came up with less barbaric evils than any medievalist in religion. So this notion that all the greatest evils or unique evils come out of religion is just historically inaccurate. I mean, there is despicable, sadistic cruelty everywhere. That's the human condition, unfortunately. Now, I will give you evidence, however, where religion has produced more good than its alternative. And I ask this of two secular professors, Pearl and Sam Olinger, O-L-I-N-E-R, teachers at Humboldt State, California State at Humboldt. And they wrote a book on altruism. There are not many books on altruism. There are 10 billion books on evil, almost none on altruism, which is too bad. And I asked them, they specifically studied rescuers of Jews during the Holocaust. And I said this, and I have it on tape. You have devoted your lives to studying altruism. You are secular.
Mr. Prager, this will be a time to continue with the questioning of
okay,
one
so this is my final statement to Christopher Hitchens. You are secular. If you could, knowing everything you know now, you are a Jew in the Holocaust, and you can knock on the door of a secular doctor, no, I didn't even say secular, a doctor, a lawyer, or a priest or a nun behind the third door, which would you knock on in the hope that they would risk their lives to save you? And they said, without question, the priest or nun.
Thank you.
Now to Dinesh. All right, now, the problem with Dinesh is so far we agree on everything, and this is a very serious problem in a debate. You might want your money back, except for two things. One, you paid nothing, and second, that there is always Christopher Hitchens here. So
I would suggest, why don't we move
that
along?
That solves the problem of disagreement.
Dennis, why don't we move along then, and we'll have Dinesh take on his rebuttal.
Well, I did want to still, nevertheless, I did want to ask you something.
I didn't feel myself being cross-examined in that last rant. I've got to say.
Yes. So let me. I do want to ask one thing of Dinesh, though. I'll be very.
Do you want to do a Pentateuch, New Testament kind of conversation?
How about if we give Christopher just a minute to respond,
and then
Dennis can ask me a question,
okay.
And then we'll
move
on.
I think after this one we'll sort of be more, throw it open.
Well, you only have to read Primo Levi. At least he'd be the one I would probably suggest first to find out that there's nothing hypothetical about the question that was just asked to me. We know, because so many Jewish people did have to wonder who they could turn to in that moment. And we know exactly what happened when they turned. Oh, well, that's great. So what, the microphone doesn't work either now. There's nothing hypothetical about the last question I was asked when it finally came to a question, because it was the fate of many, many Jewish people in Europe to have to wonder to whom they could turn in their time of extremity. And I'll tell you the place they didn't turn, which was to the churches that had made the official concordat with Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. The churches that had told their parties to vote for him in the Reichstag, the church that had told, especially the Catholic Church, that had told its bishops to celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday every year from the pulpit, which they did till April 1945, which had preached the anti-Semitism on which the Nazi Party based itself, which in many cases violated the seal of the confessional to turn over resistors, and in all cases turned over the birth records of the parishes of Bavaria and the rest of Germany, so that the Nuremberg laws could be enforced and everyone with even a particle of Jewish blood could be identified, set aside for deportation and persecution. Anyone who doesn't know this doesn't know anything about it. Not only that, not one person was excommunicated or threatened with excommunication by the church for taking part in the Final Solution. Paul Johnson, a Roman Catholic historian, estimates that 40 to 50% of the Waffen-SS were confessing, communicating Roman Catholics. Not one of them was ever threatened with the smallest punishment for what they did or were doing.
Thank you.
But let's give up. It doesn't mean that there's no relationship between Christianity and morality in this dark hour. Joseph Goebbels was expelled, was excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. He was. Why? Do you know why? For marrying a Protestant. Magda Goebbels was a Protestant and a divorcee. Joseph Goebbels had the sacraments withdrawn from him. That's the only case I know of a Nazi being threatened with discipline by the Roman Catholic Church. To dare to ask me that question in that tone of voice in this audience, I think, shows something really like moral irresponsibility. But that's my reply, and that's the short version. Okay? Try me on this again, and on the relationship between faith and totalitarianism, and I have a lot more for you. Okay? So just keep trying.
Do you believe that Jews who definitionally do not accept Jesus as their Savior or the Trinity or any Christian, specifically Christian doctrine, are saved?
I believe the answer to that is yes, although I would have to explain, but I'll answer in short form yes.
Okay.
And in fact, by the way, my evidence for this is in the Bible, because there is a scene in the Bible where Abraham, who clearly came before Jesus, didn't know Jesus, didn't accept Jesus, is described as being in heaven. So quite clearly, there has to be a mode of salvation applicable to the Old Testament before Jesus that doesn't include Jesus.
It's not fair, but I'm just curious, given that your wife is an evangelical, would she agree with you on that?
I think so, although this calls for further discussion.
Okay, so I have one other question, and that is, you will this evening, to the extent that time would allow, you would be making the argument for the God, specifically the God of Israel. Is that correct?
Yes, I would argue that Christianity takes, if you will, the Jewish idea of God, and in some senses universalizes it. I mean, the universal principle is in Judaism. It's
right.
Invented by Christianity. But in some senses...
Okay, I just wanted to understand. Go right ahead now.
My turn, right? Okay, and I have... Christopher, I'm going to start with you. Let's begin with this business about religion poisoning everything. Now, I think you would concede that much of what we call Western civilization is built on the pillars of Athens and Jerusalem. If you look at Western art, Western literature, Western sculpture, Western painting. So my question is, isn't it irresponsible to say religion poisons everything? Did religion poison Bach and Dante and Milton and Shakespeare and Raphael and Wren and the designers of the Gothic cathedrals. Can't you concede something good in religion?
Well, I think that the great cultural task is to rescue things like, say, Chartres, or Verdi's Requiem, though Verdi was able to write perfectly good Requiem without being a believer in God. And we only know about most of the painters and architects and musicians that they had better have affirmed a belief in God at the time. It would have been a very painful death for them if they had not done so. We can't be sure of their sincerity. But just as I wrote a book about the Parthenon, for example, and think it should be regarded as a great temple of our civilization, and a great, as 5th century Athens was a great flourishing of it, but I don't agree with the cult of Pallas Athena. I don't agree with Athenian imperialism in Mytilene and Sparta. I don't agree with the Eleusinian mysteries and the various dark cults that disfigured ancient.
Okay, but
it's quite possible to have the one, the glory, the architecture, the culture, the symmetry, the poetry and the music without the superstition. In fact, I would define the cultural task of agnosticism and atheism as being the recognition of the numinous and the transcendent while repudiating the superstitious and the supernatural.
But if it was the case that a belief in Jupiter or Zeus or Diana inspired the Parthenon, it would actually be simply wrong and, in fact, historically narrow-minded to say that the Greek myths poisoned everything. Clearly, they had an enormously beneficial impact because they did inspire those people who built those buildings. So unless you're claiming...
We can't know that. Well, two things. One, we can't know that the belief in these cults was sincerely affirmed rather than coerced.
Are you maintaining that?
That's the first thing. And the second thing is, if you grant this, Dinesh, if you want me to grant it, then you too have to say, well, as you very perilously have just already come close to saying, that any religion is as good as any other. You can go to heaven. Who cares that Jesus said you can only come to the Father by me?
Well, doesn't matter. You're shifting ground on me.
You have to say that the Aztecs.
You're implying preposterously
that the people who built the hideous temples based on human sacrifice everywhere from Cambodia to Mexico have just as good a claim to be the founders of our civilization. I'm sure you don't mean to make such an idiotic statement.
Well, you implied a moment ago that all these great thinkers and artists must be closet atheists who did these things despite their religious beliefs
I said that we may not speak for them. We may not say that we know what they thought.
We'll let them speak for themselves.
We may say for sure that they would not have dared to say differently. We know what happened to those who did.
Let me shift ground. One of the themes that you stressed in your opening statement earlier, and we see it consistently among other of the so-called new atheists, is this equation between Islamic extremism on the one hand and Christianity on the other. Now, in dealing with Islamic extremism, we could cite 9/11, the Bali bombing, the London bombing, the Madrid bombing, the list goes on. Who today would you say... Let me finish my question. It's my time. It's my time. Who would you say today is the Christian bin Laden? Where's the Christian Al-Qaeda? Where's the Christian Hamas and Hezbollah? Where's the Christian country run today along the lines of Khomeini's Iran? Name them.
But I don't have to. I've never made any sense.
Will you admit then that this analogy is specious and that in fact there are fundamental differences between Christianity and Islam that the new atheists have been exploiting to, in a sense, transfer the guilt of Islamic radicalism onto Christianity?
If you had asked me in the 1930s which religious belief I thought was the most threatening to the survival of human society and civilization, I would have said Roman Catholicism because of its very intimate and deep and nasty relationship with fascism. At that stage, the greatest threat to the humanity was not jihadism. But at present, it is. Religions take their turn at bat. In Northern Ireland, Protestantism has been far more oppressive and obscurantist than Catholicism, even, for the last half century. I would regard that as anomalous. But there's no way, just as you can't answer my question about why, in that case, don't you credit the builders of mosques and Aztec temples and Khmer temples, too, and say that all of these prove that religion is the origin of civilization. You won't do that because it would be too ecumenical for you.
Dinesh, you have 3 minutes to use as you see fit.
I have three more minutes. Oh, I see. I'm going to put one more question to Christopher and then switch to Dennis, if I may. I'm going to come back and answer your points about Hitler and anti-Semitism, so I'm going to hold off on them now. You say in your book, God is Not Great, that you think that Jesus Christ did not even exist. You consider seriously the possibility that he was a fictional character. And I'd like to ask you, by what standard of scholarship do you do this? For example, for Socrates, and I think that there's probably no sane philosopher or historian of philosophy who doubts that Socrates existed. We have only two sources, really, for Socrates, both admiring disciples, Plato and Xenophon, and they give very different portraits of Socrates. So my question is, if Socrates existed by accepted canons of historical scholarship, on what basis do you deny the historicity, forget the divinity, just the historicity of Christ?
Well, you only had to turn another page to see that I say that there's no proof of the existence of Socrates either. Oh, I'm so sorry. Dinesh,
Alexander the Great? Did he exist?
You only have to turn another page to see my say in my discussion of Athenian philosophy that there's no proof of the existence of Socrates either. I make the point almost as you do. I say it's with the exception of two people who were admirers, we can't be certain that he existed at all, but it doesn't make any difference.
Christopher,
because
virtually
the Socratic, I can revere the Socratic method without having any need at all to deify or put on a pedestal, make superhuman the person who invented it.
No, the point I'm making is...
Sorry, you've just dug a pit, not the first time this evening, you've just dug a pit for yourself with your own hands.
I was just making the point that the historicity of virtually every figure in the ancient world, from Alexander the Great, relies on fragmentary evidence, and so canons of historical scholarship generally accept reliability, even when there's partial documentary evidence, if there are no reasons to believe
the
contrary.
Well, there's no evidence but
you're
yes,
elevating
then.
The degree of skepticism in dealing with Christ that you would nowhere
apply to any
other figure.
There is no evidence but the hearsay of fans.
I want to switch to Dennis Prager and
Jesus of Nazareth. Alexander the Great at least has coins with his face on them.
I'm going to put one quick question.
And name.
One question to Dennis Prager, if
Written
I may.
Written down by literate people. There's nothing of that for Jesus or Moses.
Christopher, you are engaging in the filibuster. All right.
No, answering the question, I think, otherwise you could have accused me of not doing so. There is no evidence of any kind for the existence of Moses or Jesus. None. At all. Of the kind that there is for Alexander the Great. Not to know the difference.
Let's just say this puts you wide outside the mainstream of the entire living historical community. But let me turn to Dennis Prager.
I've been to the grave sites of the Macedonian royal house. You won't find Jesus' grave in a hurry. And they haven't found Mount Sinai yet.
Yeah, he's.
Go look for Mount Sinai. Tell me when he found it.
Dennis, I'm gonna pose to you a tough question, and I'm a little surprised Christopher hasn't posed it, but it's a problem for me in thinking about Christianity, particularly because of its relationship with Judaism. In looking at the teachings of Christ, you find a counsel of mercy, forgiveness, love, and so on. Even the atheists have a little bit of a hard time, although Christopher strains at the leash here, I have a little bit of a hard time attacking Jesus. It's a little bit hard to denounce the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. On the other hand, there are some passages in the Old Testament that do give one pause. Ideas of an Old Testament God who seems vengeful, who identifies so completely with one group that the enemies of this group become the enemies of God. These people are wiped out, decimated, their children taken into slavery. How do you explain those passages?
I do explain the passages, and then I have a rebuttal for you then. But first, the enemies of Israel are only wiped out to the extent, first of all, they're never fully wiped out. I mean, but whatever it is, they're certainly warred on and they're decimated, if not wiped out. But in any event, only because of their evil, and the Torah makes that clear, the first five books of Moses, that they had to reach a level of evil where they deserved it. And the evil was almost always identified as child sacrifice. That is what the Canaanites engaged in. The greatness of the Hebrew Bible, and since we're now making these comparisons, and everyone here who knows anything about me knows of my gratitude and respect and every good feeling toward America's Christians and toward the contribution of Christianity in this country specifically and elsewhere as well. But if you are going to make that comparison, I find it far more morally troubling that there, you, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, it is filled with Jewish self-criticism. The villains of the Hebrew Bible are the Hebrews, not non-Jews, Jews. But that is not the case in the New Testament. The Christians are terrific. The Jews of the Jewish Bible stink, with a handful of exceptions. The self-criticism, the constant saying about how bad they are, they get out of Egypt, they build a golden calf after all of the miracles. So this comparison is not one I like making, but if since you've opened this Pandora's box, I am very welcome to making that comparison. Secondly, the Jews' God judged everybody, including pagans, by their decency, not by their belief. The Jew who reads the New Testament, and I have spectacular respect for what the New Testament has created, especially in this, the greatest country in the world. I remember when I first read it, I was stunned at the amount of people who ended up in hell. This is something totally foreign to me as a Jew, where people were punished solely because they were bad, never because of their wrong beliefs. So, and finally, the God of the Old Testament is the one who said, love your neighbor as yourself. I am God. Leviticus 19:18. It's literally the center of the Torah. It's in the middle of the third book of the Bible.
Thank you. I'm quite sure there's more to be said on punishment in hell in the next few minutes. I'm going to suggest, for the sake of time and to allow for questions, that because this is your penultimate statement, so let's try and truncate them to 3 minutes, 3 to 4 right now in the rebuttals. And then maybe we'll do more of a worldwide wrestling approach to the final cross-exam. So, Mr. Hitchens, 3 to 4 minutes?
I'm very happy to be able to agree with Dennis in his last point. The great advantage of Judaism is its engagement with Hellenism. Dinesh said that the pillars were Athens and Jerusalem. Actually, you have to pretty much choose between Athens and Jerusalem. And Orthodox Judaism very strongly emphasizes this point by describing as the heretic the Apikoros. I'm sure I'm telling you something that most of you already know. The Epicurean, the follower of Lucretius, and forcing people to confront this heresy and to say, this is the terrible thing the Hellenists and the Hellenized believe, and thus, in many cases, making people think actually it doesn't sound too bad. And this is a risk that Judaism is dialectically prepared to run, and I think it does make it both morally and intellectually superior to the fantasy of Christianity and the hideous idea of vicarious redemption by human sacrifice, the morally obscene idea that by torturing somebody to death you can have your own sins taken away from you, commonly known in the bleaker bits of the Old Testament as scapegoating, something that's actively hideous and immoral as a belief. Now, I think I probably have to confront this question again of... or it may seem to you for the first time, of why is there something rather than nothing? The best answer I ever heard to this was by Professor Sidney Morgenbesser, who said, if there was nothing, you'd still be complaining. he was a great ironic figure. I think the question can be rephrased, if you will. 99% of all the species ever known to have existed on this planet, 99.8 actually, have ceased to exist, have become extinct. In our own solar system, we are the only planet that functions. All the others are either too damn hot or too damn cold, just in our own little cosmic suburb. And that's true of huge swathes of our own planet. And as you know, whatever you think about global warming, there's always a climatological crisis in our planet, because it's always on a climatological knife edge between being too hot and being too cold. And one day it's going to just flame out. And that's just in the suburb where we live. If you look at it cosmologically and look at what Edwin Hubble discovered about the acceleration, the red shift, the rate at which the universe is expanding, it was very shocking for physicists to discover more recently that rate is not declining, as Newtonian physics would suggest, but it's accelerating. The universe is exploding away faster than we thought it would. And very soon, we'll come to nothingness. Out of the somethingness we now do have, nothingness is absolutely built in. So that's some design for those of you who believe that this must have an author and a creator. Whoever did this is planning for nothingness as the next big thing. And in the meantime, The Andromeda galaxy is headed directly for us and is due in about 4 billion years, which is tomorrow in evolutionary time.
Thank you.
How do you like those apples?
What kind
of designer is this? And it replaces the question exactly where philosophy poses it in the first place. If you assume a designer, how do you explain his incompetence? And how do you explain his cruelty, his callousness, his stupidity, and his indifference? And that question can't be evaded by any of the pseudo-scientific cleverness we've heard this evening. And real science, even the contemplation of it, will show that the question is hollow. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Prager.
Look, I said earlier I said earlier that I fully acknowledge, and every thoughtful religious person acknowledges, the problem of an unjust world. The alternative would have been a perfectly just world. I have a deep desire for a perfectly just world where nothing unjust could happen, nobody could hurt anybody, no man could rape a woman, no parent could abuse a child, where there was no premenstrual syndrome. I could imagine a perfect world in many ways. Would the world be one worth living in? I don't know. What happens to give meaning to life, ironically, is what, for one thing, death. I mean, if I knew I was going to live forever, I'm not sure how much I would read, because I know, like, you know, why should I read that book? I could read it 2,000 years from now. Why should I get out of bed? I'm here forever. I don't have perfect answers for this, but the alternative doesn't fill me, frankly, with great desire either. The Jewish view is that God did make an uncompleted world, and it is the human task to repair it, to complete it. That's why the traditional understanding for circumcision on the eighth day, the 7 days of creation, six plus the day of rest, and on the eighth day, we're already manipulating nature, as if to say it wasn't perfect, the human body, we'll make it a little better and get rid of the foreskin. Whatever you have to say about it, it's a symbolic notion that we are here. I don't lament the loss of my foreskin, Christopher, so we don't. It is not an issue I want to get into. It's among the many trauma of my life that has not been high on the list.
Never buy crackling from a moil.
Okay, now, I do want to say one other thing, though, since I have one more minute only. Christopher said it's very possible to have great cultural achievements without the supernatural. Really? Really? May I offer this thought as one who is a part-time orchestral conductor and deeply involved in classical music? By and large, the death of God in the Western world has led to the death of great art. Music since the age of secularism stinks. Art since the age of secularism stinks. What our art galleries are filled with today are fecal matter, urine, menstrual blood, and the like. They are moronic cartoons that fill our galleries. It was only God and the pervasiveness of God in the Western world that produced great art. It is an empty, empty chamber, the secular chamber.
Mr. D'Souza.
I thought I would focus my rebuttal on two themes that I think have been brought front and center in this debate. The first one is the offer of a prize, which always gets my attention. Name a principle of virtue invented by theism. And I'm going to name one invented specifically by Christianity. That is the movement to abolish slavery. Slavery is a universal institution. It's existed in all cultures. For millennia, slavery needed no defenders because it had no critics. Now, for the first time in Western civilization, slavery became controversial. Not just in the modern era, slavery was abolished in most of Europe between the 4th century and the 10th century. And then starting in the modern era, groups of people, first the Quakers and then the evangelical Christians, took a theological premise, we are all created equal in the eyes of God, and derived from it a political conclusion. Therefore, no man has the right to rule another man without his consent. This idea, this political application of a theological maxim, became the basis not merely of anti-slavery or abolition, but also of modern democracy, because the premise of modern representative democracy is precisely that no man has the right to rule another without consent. Here is a distinct and I think unarguable historical example. I don't deny there were Christians on the other side, of a virtue that was not in the world before the Christians, based on a theological proposition, derived it. There have been no purely atheist anti-slavery movements anywhere. Now, I now want to address the issue of Hitler, because you have to remember that Hitler, in Mein Kampf, says very clearly that I will say anything, propaganda, he defines, as lying to achieve a goal. And in the early years, in the 1930s, in fact, if you go to atheist websites, you'll see a lot of quotations in which Hitler seems to endorse Christianity and the cross. You'll notice those quotations are all between about 1933 and they stop about 1936. Why? In the early years, Hitler was trying to win over the Bavarian Catholics and the Lutheran Protestants, and so he invented an Aryan Christ, sort of the killer of the Jews, and tried to sell this to the German churches. They didn't buy it. And so the moment Hitler got to power, and by the way, Hitler's own views on Christianity extensively stated in a book called Hitler's Table Talk, assembled by his own close aides, he dripped with venom and hatred for Christianity. He saw it as the main obstacle to creating a secular, race-based utopia. And the leading people around Hitler, Bormann, Heydrich, Himmler, were avowed atheists who were given the specific charge of undermining and destroying the churches in Germany. All of this is pretty well outlined in Richard Evans' multi-volume History of the Third Reich. So this idea that Hitler was some sort of a closet Christian, complete nonsense. Now, one thing that Christopher does in these debates is he takes the crimes of Christianity and he blames them on Christianity, and then he takes the crimes of atheism and he blames them on Christianity. Now, this is cheating. The philosopher Daniel Dennett said very clearly, and I realize I've just got a few seconds, he said, listen, if Islam is to blame for Hamas and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, if there's something about Islam that gave rise to that, and if even the ordinary Muslim must take some responsibility for that, and if even if the peace-loving Christian bears some responsibility for the Crusades and the Inquisition and the Salem witch trials, by the same logical token and extension, even the peace-loving atheist, yes, even you, Christopher, bear some responsibility for the horrendous crimes, the ocean of blood and the mountain of bodies, not just Mao, not just Stalin, even a junior leaguer like Pol Pot, he's a little league atheist, doesn't even make it in the top category. He kills about 2 million in the space of 3 years. So you can't get around that. Atheism was their inspiration, and the creation of a new man in a new utopia, liberated from traditional religion and morality. This was, in fact, the goal of those atheist regimes.
Thank you. I think what might work better is if, Christopher, you just take 5 minutes and essentially if you can cross-examine, jump in, rebut, whatever, and then as long as it doesn't turn into a tag team, we just sort of do with what proceed from there. So take five.
I'll do it in reverse order, if you don't mind. I'll take what's fresh in your mind. I was talking not just about Hitler's attitude to the church, which was indeed very conflicted, and though not a secular one, the desire to replace religion with a Nordic, Aryan, race-based paganism may be many things, but it's not secular. I was talking about the church's attitude to fascism and National Socialism, and that's what disgraces Christianity. They had to know. If you're right, Dinesh, they had to know that the ultimate aim of National Socialism was to depose their church. That didn't stop them groveling to it and sharing with it in the two main pillars of its propaganda, anti-Semitism and hatred of Marxism. Now, if you want me to accept responsibility for the Khmer Rouge, because I don't believe in God, you're not going to get me to do it. Okay? And there's no one in this room who would think that was a fair indictment. If I say I don't believe in God, I do not become responsible for the crimes of Pol Pot, by definition. If I had published an article saying the Khmer Rouge were misunderstood agricultural reformers, as I do have some friends on the left who I would have to say remain my friends, did, then I would have to feel a twinge about the crimes of the Khmer Rouge, but not otherwise. And if you think that North Korea, where I've been, is a secular state, you overlook the fact that it is based upon the worship of a dead man whose son is his reincarnation. It's one short of a trinity. It's the most perfectly religious state I've ever seen. And if you don't realize there's a connection between Stalinism and the pre-existing cult of the Tsar, a supreme head of the state who was also head of a church and considered to have supernatural properties, then you haven't done much work in cultural studies. And if I say, I don't think that God created the universe or me, I don't become responsible for the gulag. And is there anyone here who can supply the middle term to the syllogism that would suggest that I do? Quite plainly not. In order for your charge to work, you would have to point to a society or a state that adopted as its ruling precepts the ideas of Lucretius and Democritus and Epicurus and Galileo and Spinoza and Jefferson and Voltaire and Einstein and Richard Dawkins and then fell into slavery, backwardness, famine, and the rest of it. And you won't be able to find such a society, and you won't be able to have a proper comparison or a fair level playing field in that way. Actually, the nearest there is to such a society is the great republic in which we are this evening met, the only country in the world that ever has written itself a secular constitution, and much of whose glory is precisely for that reason. Now, I'm sorry to say that the same thing is true of slavery. It was essential, of course, that there be Christian anti-slavery movements, and I don't say that there weren't, and Christian anti-slavery activists, because theirs was the responsibility. The warrant for slavery was biblical to begin with. The warrant for slavery was found in the Bible and preached by the churches. The motto of the Confederacy, when they declared they'd rather have a war than give up the peculiar institution, was Deo Vindice, God on our side, God with us, God will vindicate us. For every Christian who was an anti-slavery activist, there were millions and millions of Christians who did not just passively but actively supported the institution, whereas the main founders of the American Anti-Slavery Society, men like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine, had no God. So your point, I'm sorry to say, falls. Now, just on the point that Dennis made, he confused my remarks about the chaotic and disordered and undesigned nature of the cosmos and the universe with the demand for everything to be just. I didn't say everything should be just and we should complain that it's not. I said that if you claim it's ordered and designed, you will have a very serious problem, because into the design and into the order is built chaos and ultimate collapse and nothingness. So that the indictment of your designer will be the same as it would be if you hadn't started to argue in that way. But that there is so much injustice and that there is so much random misery and unfairness is not my problem. It is the problem for those who say, and I'll rest on this, those who look at the idea of a God and who say, a God who would make a penis that needs to be snipped, it's so badly thought out. Some designer. The word for this was, this phrase, this was come, it was come up with by the great poet Fulk Greville. A long time ago, he said, if you believe this, then you believe that we are created sick and then ordered to be well. That can only be done by a heartless, cruel, incompetent designer. Voila.
If I designed the world, I would have designed it differently as well. I would have definitely made celery fattening and cheesecake healthy. I have innumerable designs that I would have done better than God. I have no doubt about it. Absolutely. But to me, this is meaningless talk. I mean, these are the things that, you know, I argued with kids in the third grade. You know, they'd say, Dennis, you believe in God? I'd go, yeah. Oh, really? You think he's all powerful? I'd go, yeah. Well, is he so strong that he can make a rock so heavy that he can't lift it? And then they'd walk away thinking they had just, you know, discovered America, that they had just this brilliant insight. Or, well, if everything needs to be started, who started God? These are not serious arguments. If God is not natural, so therefore God doesn't need to be started. Only things within nature need to be started because everything in nature did. As for design, of course, I told you, I admit it, I have design questions. But if you look at the spectacular way in which the brain, the eye, the body works, my brother was at Harvard Medical School when he came to firmly believe in God, and he did so looking at the cell. The infinite complexity of just one cell with the endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi bodies and everything else that is happening in there. Now, of course, you could say it happened on its own, and that's what I began by saying. Since neither of us has proof for our position, it's, to me, a matter of common sense. That's all. One just asks, what is the likelihood of it coming about on its own versus the likelihood of its having been designed? There are scientists who are also stymied by this question, and they have posited, since they refuse to believe in a supernatural deity, they have posited that extraterrestrials planted seeds here because it seems so inconceivable that this just happened in earthly terms. Now, as to just a couple of other points that are made, I mean, once a secularist says that North Korea is religious, I think that we have gone beyond the realm of definitional terms. It's a completely secular state. If you are religious in a God-based religion, that's what we're talking about. The debate here was about God. Of course, there are secular religious substitutes for God-based religion. That argues on our behalf, it seems to me, that the human being is designed to find meaning and that in the godless universe there is no meaning, and of course there isn't. Yeah, there's subjective meaning. I like gardening. I like my kids. Of course there's subjective meaning, but in the final analysis, all is nothing. After all, everything is destroyed. We're all a coincidence anyway. There is no designer. It's all meaningless. Now, here is the question that I'll just have to end with. I just ask you who are atheists to ask yourself the 3 a.m. question. Do you really, really, really believe that in the final analysis all really is meaningless? It's hard. You see, I go through the other entrance to the building of belief. It's secularism that makes me believe. That is so obvious to me that it's not possible that this is a meaningless world, then there must be a meaning giver. And that is what we call God. Do I have problems? Who thinks and doesn't have problems? But the purpose of life is not to be trouble-free. But one purpose of life is to have meaning, and without God, that's when you end up with what you see in your galleries and you see the moral chaos of the secular university. Because without God, all is permitted. And because when there is no God, people don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And these are the things that keep me quite balanced. And with all my doubts, I believe in the God that this Torah revealed to the world.
Thank you.
I must say I love these debates, and I particularly like these rebuttals. I always feel a bit like Winston Churchill said he felt during the Boer War. He said, it's always exhilarating to be shot at without result. So I want to begin by addressing briefly slavery. Remember that slavery was for many centuries like the family. It was taken for granted. Slavery existed in the ancient world, and in fact, you had something very close to what we would consider atheists in the ancient world. Christopher mentioned Lucretius, Epicurus, Aristotle in some sense. He posited a first mover. They were not in any profound way bothered by slavery. Nobody was. Slavery only became controversial within what we could call Christendom. For the first time, slavery had critics. For the first time, there was a movement behind it. That movement would not have existed were it not for Christianity. This point, by the way, can be greatly extended. I mean, for example, human life had very little value in ancient Greece and Rome. The ancient Spartans would leave the sick child on the hillside, happy to find it dead in the morning. That's not the scandal. The scandal is the great atheist thinkers of ancient Greece. Epicurus, Lucretius, Aristotle knew about this. But they viewed this with complete equanimity. It didn't bother them. It was no big deal. Why? Because the idea of the sacredness and preciousness of every human life, this comes through Judaism to Christianity. These are new things, if you will, that Judaism and Christianity brought into the world. I want to talk about, you mentioned Franklin, Jefferson. These were, by the way, the least devout of all the founders. And yet Jefferson, when he wanted to condemn slavery, used surprisingly biblical language. The Almighty can take no side of ours in this kind of a contest. The unbeliever Jefferson became peculiarly devout. And when Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, a considered document, had to locate the source of our rights, he could think of only one, the Creator. No other. This was a man of the Enlightenment who could find no secular sources for rights to appeal to other than transcendent Creator. Finally, a point about, the only point I wanted to make about the crimes of religion and atheism are this. Christopher says he doesn't want to feel bad about the Khmer Rouge, and that's fine. But then he proceeds to show that Stalinism and North Korea were really disguised forms of religion, so he's trying to make Dennis and me feel bad about those things, even though we had nothing to do with them any more than he did. So there's a sleight of hand going on here, and that's all I'm objecting to. We need an equal calculus. If you read Henry Kamen's multi-volume study of the Inquisition, you discover that over a period of some 350 years, the Spanish Inquisition, which was the worst, killed about 2,000 people. Now, that's 2,000 too many, but 2,000 people over three... I'm not a math major. It works to about five guys a year. This is not a world historical crime. An ordinary atheist on a good afternoon would wipe out multiples of these people. Now, Christopher Hitchens came, Richard Dawkins in his book The God Delusion says, but wait a minute, the atheists, the Christians killed in the name of Christianity. You might have had tyrants who happened to be atheists, but they didn't kill in the name of atheism. Now see, Dawkins is an accomplished biologist, but there's a bit of a problem when you let a biologist leave the lab, because here's a guy with no understanding whatsoever of history. You just have to crack open the Communist Manifesto to see that atheism isn't incidental. It is integral to the Marxist philosophy. Religion is the opium or the opiate of the masses. The idea is to create a society in which religion is abolished and class, and in the case of the Nazis, race, replaces traditional religious loyalties as the ultimate allegiance of man. Thank you.
Thank you. As these gentlemen make their closing arguments, this is the opportunity for the ushers to come through the aisles because it's not a revival. The only contribution they will be seeking is your questions. If you would make them short, there's a much better chance we'll be able to get to them. Just pass them back to the edge of the aisle at any point during the next 15 minutes, and the ushers will come collect them, and we'll get through as many of them as we can. So with that, if you are ready, shall we begin? Mr. Hitchens, I think we have... We've got more.
All right. Okay. Well, listen. Let me just tell you a couple of things about the ideology of Kim Il-sungism in North Korea. It says that Kim Il-sung was miraculously born, and that on the day of his birth, birds sang in Korean to witness the miraculous birth. Birds don't sing in Korean, I can promise that, or any other human language. That he is not dead, he is still the president of North Korea. When President Bush writes to Kim Jong-il, he refers to him as Dear Mr. Chairman, not Dear Mr. President, because though Kim Jong-il is the head of the party and of the army of North Korea, he is not the head of the state. That office has been held for the past 13 years by a dead man, who isn't dead but has been reincarnated in the person of his son. In other words, North Korea is what you might call a necrocracy, or a thanatocracy, or a mausolocracy, But you can, and you can call it many things. You may not call it secular. It is a state entirely based on mysticism, worship, and supernatural intervention. Not to know this is not to know anything about it. The statement that religion is the opium of the people was never made by Karl Marx and appears nowhere in the Communist Manifesto. If you go to fine bookstores anywhere and get hold of a copy of God Is Not Great, you can find quite early on the full quotation, which comes from Marx's critique of Georg Friedrich Hegel's philosophy of right, in which he says of religion that it is the heart of the heartless world, the sigh of the oppressed creature, the spirit of the spiritless situation, an opiate for the people, and adding that religion has plucked the flowers from the chain, not so that men may wear the chain without consolation, but so that they may break the chain and cull the living flower. I'm willing to say that much for Marxism against vulgar defamations of it and of any other defamation of what is the atheist position and also the atheist understanding of what the wellsprings of religion really are. Is it now, how true is it that without God everything is permitted? You might say that a person would say, well, it's without a divine intervention, without a supervision, without a totalitarian, a celestial dictator watching my every move who can convict me of thought crime. And who wants this to be true? Who would like this to be the case? I'll leave that question with you. But without it, suppose without the dictator, people would just do what they liked. Well, isn't it just as true, Dennis, that with that dictator and his orders, everything is also permitted? Because if God orders you to do it, you may have to go and kill all the members of the other tribe, not sparing even their children, and be rebuked if you even spare some, as is countlessly enjoined in the Bible. You may find that you've got to go and blow yourself up in order to get to heaven and take as many unbelievers with you, because to do things that no secularist would think about doing, because God's instructions require it. In other words, with God, it seems that an incredible number of things are permitted as well, if not just permitted, actually ordered of you, required of you, which may include extremely cruel and criminal acts. Now, we've got no further this evening, I'm sorry to say, but this is what I'm hoping for in the question period. We've got no further than deism, or at least my opponents have got no further than deism, than the suggestion that because so many things are the way they are, there must be some kind of authorship or design. This is a very, very hoary argument. Indeed, it's been multiply rebutted. I've given you some of the refutations of the argument from design already this evening. But let's suppose I grant them or say that I can't overthrow them. How are they going to get from deism to theism? How are they going to get from an ultimate author or possible designer or prime cause to someone who cares who you sleep with and in what position? Or who cares how you mutilate your genitalia? Or who cares what you do on a Friday or a Saturday? Or cares for what you eat? Or can tell you what to do and how to get to heaven? How does deism help you to get to theism? How does the Big Bang lead to answered prayers or virgin births or miraculous interventions in human affairs? All of these things remain to be proved or so far on the part of my antagonists even argued for. Not one of them has even tried, you must have noticed, to make a case to you this evening that if you don't believe this, there's no redemption for you.
Thank you.
There's not one statement in favor of religion has been made from this platform all evening. I find that striking as an example of how far secularism has penetrated without people even noticing it.
Thank you, Mr. Prager.
Well, I can only speak for myself that I have the idiosyncratic tendency to only talk about the topic. The topic is the Christian God, the Jewish God.
Well, now's
the
your
God.
Chance, then.
Okay, I didn't interrupt you. The topic was not the case for religion. The topic was about God. God or no God, specifically the Christian perception, the Jewish perception, or the atheist perception of no God. That's what we discussed.
Exactly.
Now, that's because that was the topic, and that's what we were invited to discuss. However, now, having been invited to discuss Where is the transition made from the Creator God to a religion and a series of beliefs? I'll offer you in a nutshell a Jewish response. If there is a God who created the human, then it strikes me, again, purely on logical grounds, that God would care about how the humans that God created fare. If we care about how humans fare, it would seem that the Creator of us would care how we fare, or we are superior to our Creator. I find that notion possible, but unlikely. So the odds are that God did care if we were good to each other. And so this is my read, that God implants a conscience in the human being. It obviously failed, and whether you take it as an allegory or literally, and I am more toward the allegorical, but it is irrelevant. I'm totally happy with those who take it literally. It means nothing to me which way you go. The very first two human beings are brothers, and one murders the other. Clearly, something goes awry very quickly, and so God then destroys the world because he's interested in our being good. I have never had a moral problem with Noah's flood. I'm not even arguing for a literal understanding. I'm arguing for taking the story and what it means. It means that God wants goodness to prevail. If it doesn't, there is no purpose to human life. He starts over again and gives Noah a series of laws to live by, since conscience was not enough. That doesn't work, and God makes a third attempt to make the world better and gives a very explicit revelation of moral law to a small people, a particularly miserable people, a particularly ugly people, and a particularly small people called Hebrews. They are slaves. Slave mentality is a very low form, the lowest form of human mentality. And God chooses this tiny group, not because it's at all better. In fact, the Bible itself says you're not better than anybody else. In fact, you're smaller. You're nothing. And if that group can elevate itself among the peoples and be in some ways a moral light, which Jews have been, despite the number of miserable Jews, as there are miserable peoples of any group, but Judaism did give Christianity, did give the moral ideals that the Western world lives by, and Jews did become a people that elevated itself in many ways, then it's ascribed to this third revelation from Adam, the conscience, to Noah, a universal a series of few laws, to a lot of laws, to one people to try to embody it. Now, I would like to add at this point a fourth. Can you give me a minute?
40 seconds.
How do we go from a minute to 20 seconds inside of 10 seconds? All right, I will
take
just
1 minute.
Okay. There is something I want.
The equivalent of God in this podium.
I'm sorry?
She's playing God in the podium.
Correct. I do want to add something here, because then comes Christianity, and I want to just, the time factor is more troublesome than even on radio when I have to break for commercials. But nevertheless, it's inevitable, and I appreciate that. A very quick word on how this religious Jew sees Christianity, because you heard how a religious Christian sees Judaism. I believe that Christianity, when rooted in the Hebrew Bible, as indeed Christianity in America certainly has been, this has been a very Judeo-Christian Christianity in America. I believe it is an expression of divine will. I do not believe that there is only one road to God, nor does Judaism. The most Orthodox Jew in the world, the most insular, most isolated Orthodox Jew, would never say that only Jews can reach God or only Jews are saved. It has never, ever, ever been a Jewish position. Those who come to this God and to this Ten Commandments, these are doing God's will. I see the Christians of America having done God's will, and a form, if you will, of divine revelation in its way. And that is the reason many Christians find it remarkable how much I defend Christians. But after all, Dennis, don't you believe there's only one truth? I believe there's only one empirical truth, but I don't believe there is only one way to God, and nor does my religion. And so I just want to explain how I can accommodate so well, while being a truly believing Jew, so how I can so accommodate to the achievement of the Christian, especially in America, where we share this basic body of values called Judeo-Christian.
Thank you.
It's particularly delightful and challenging to debate these issues from sort of multiple perspectives. If Christopher feels a little bit of excessive ecumenism on the side of Dennis and me, I'm going to be departing from that in just a moment. But I do want to say a couple of things first. And that is, the problem of evil, the problem of cruelty, of harsh, unnecessary suffering, is often posed as an exclusive dilemma or difficulty for the believer. I want to suggest it is no less a difficulty for the atheist. And why? Because if we are Darwinian primates, driven by an imperative to survive and reproduce, we would in general only commit that evil which was necessary to that end. The amount of evil in the world, it's scale staggers the mind. It has no reproductive benefit. It has no survival advantage. Look at the animal kingdom. You might have a lion that wants to eat an antelope, but you don't have a lion that wants to wipe out all the antelopes off the face of the planet. In a sense, when we see horrible things, a serial killer, we say that was a bestial act you did, but it's wrong. Beasts don't act that way. So there is something peculiar about the nature of man that makes him capable of a degree of evil that is goes way beyond Darwinian necessity, requires almost an alternative explanation.
It's now, because he's created in God's image.
No. Now, what I want to say is, why have the atheist killings of the 20th century been so terrible? I think the answer is simple. Christopher mentioned earlier Dostoevsky's maxim, if God is not, everything is permitted. I want to give you Nietzsche, the philosopher Nietzsche, probably the greatest atheist thinker of the last 150 years, his interpretation of this. But basically what Nietzsche says is that if you remove God, many people want to get rid of God but hang on to the morality that the idea of God brought into the world. But you really can't do this. If you get rid of God, you get rid of the foundation of those values that emanated out of the transcendent idea. For example, the simple idea that you owe equal respect and dignity, not just to a family member or a neighbor, but to a complete stranger. From a Darwinian point of view, this is completely senseless. There is absolutely no reason that one should extend bonds of sympathy, for example, to someone starving in Rwanda. They are nothing to me. We have no genes in common. Now, religion is a theory of cosmic justice. If you think of the Hindu idea of reincarnation, you were a jerk in the way you've acted, well, you're going to be a cockroach in your next life. So religion introduces the idea that even though life is unfair, and many times in life the bad guy ends up on top and the good guy comes to grief, there will be a final accounting in the end in which what goes around comes around. And I want to submit that theists who did bad things had to pay attention to this. Even if Torquemada was a horrible guy, if he was a believer, he had to worry about the last judgment. But Stalin did not, and Mao did not, and Pol Pot did not. Do I have a moment for a final thought about Christianity?
30 seconds.
Human beings are at this level, down here, but we have within us this aspiration to perfection, perfect beauty, perfect justice, perfect truth. Man is down here, God is up here. I see most of the religions of the world as trying to create a ladder from man to God. Follow these rules, perform these diets, obey these commandments. It's the premise of Christianity that these ladders, however well constructed, cannot reach their destination. It's too high. Man can't get up there. God has to come down. God has to condescend to the human level. That's the only way to close the chasm. And so in Christ, symbolically, we see, in a sense, God becoming man, a way to reach down to man, bridge that gap, and open up an opportunity, you might say, for human salvation. Thank you.
Revealed himself to his people. Today, folks, including Richard Dawkins, ask, why doesn't God just reveal himself again and end the argument about his existence once and for all? Do you think there's any chance he might?
There is a chance he might. I've asked this question often. What is it Woody Allen has said in one of his movies? If just God would sneeze, I would be happy. All I just want is a sneeze, and that would be sufficient. My belief is that if God did some spectacular miracle, the heavens lit up all over the world and in hundreds of languages, clouds formed the words, I am God, you better take care of each other. It would have an impact for approximately 3 days. May, for some people, forever. But immediately there would be explanations of cloud formations that scientists would come up with. It wouldn't matter. That's the brilliance of the story, to my mind, at any rate, in the Bible, and where the Jews are shown all these miracles and then end up building a golden calf anyway. I mean, shortly after, you know, the sea was split, and they still built a golden calf. That is human nature, because we always ask, what did you do for me today? That's the way it is. We are children in many ways, and God is this paternalistic figure. And just as our children don't walk around thinking, my God, you diapered me all those years? Wow. I mean, how many babies say, you know, I've prevented my parents from having intimacy for the last 3 months. I'm going to shut up tonight. It just doesn't happen. The human is not built in with gratitude. And so the same thing with God. It's, what did you do for me lately? So I don't think it would work if God did make some revelation. And finally, I don't think there's anything for God to reveal. There's nothing new to be said. It's been said. There's nothing new to be said. It is our task. There is an instruction manual that I believe in, and if you follow it, generally speaking, people are kinder. And if you don't follow it, or you pervert it, then obviously bad happens. But I don't know, what is God going to add today? What exactly? Don't abuse children? Don't build the gas chambers? What hasn't been said? It's been said. It's our task to say either I will live by it or not. But that's my answer to that question.
Actually, there is nothing against child abuse or genocide in the Ten Commandments, since you happen to mention this.
Well, there is. There's do not murder. There is. Murder means the immoral killing of an innocent. So there is, in fact, a prescription.
There's nothing for child abuse and nothing against genocide.
Well,
genocide is about to be recommended against the Amalekites only a few pages later.
Yes, against the Amalekites, it is one exception because of a horrific evil. It never happened, but that it is prescribed. I have no answer to it. Just as I cannot tell you that if God people say, well, what if God told you to sacrifice your child, like He
and
told
no
Abraham?
And no condemnation of slavery or child abuse.
Okay, God. Well,
but
there
of coveting,
is, well,
yes. Of envy, wait. Yes. Well, of ambition, yes.
Okay.
This is obviously man-made, and man-made at a time of Stone Age morality.
Okay.
There's no divine presence or inspiration in it at all. Surely that must be plain.
Oh, well, that is a matter of opinion. My opinion is that the break with everything preceding the Old Testament, specifically the first five books, is so enormous that it you have to either explain its authors as supermen or some divine authorship involved. The notion that there is an invisible God who prefers goodness to evil was unknown in the world. The idea that this life is to be celebrated. Remember, Judaism arose out of Egypt. In Egypt, the Book of the Dead was the Bible. The pyramids were the great works of art, and they were tombs. The Egyptians celebrated death. And it was that Torah coming out of Egypt that said, I have put before you life and death, and you shall choose life. It is an utterly life-centered idea in the midst of a death-centered world. Ironically, Israel is, to this day, 2008, still in a death-centered world.
Question from Mr. Hitchens. You state that you don't want God, or God as you define him, to exist. But what if it turned out that this God, unlike many of his flawed followers, were full of mercy and love towards those who suffer? The God of the prodigal son, be it the parable, the painting, or the book. Would that be a God you could accept?
No, because let me say what I think about the underlay of that question, which is, people try to design the sort of God they would like. This is a part of the religious cafeteria of which I'm so critical. The God, if he exists, does not owe me an explanation. It would be idle, it seems to me, and trivial to say, well, if you exist, why are you cruel? It's boring and self-pitying to talk like that. Pascal says in his famous wager, well, what have you got to lose? If he does exist, you may find yourself tremendously fortunate if you make the right propitiations and if you agree with his existence. And if he doesn't, well, then you haven't lost a thing. Now, I regard that as another example of the essential immorality of religious preachment. That seems to me a hucksterish thing to be saying on Pascal's part. My reply to it would be, Bertrand Russell's reply to this, by the way, was, if he was confronted with God on the day he died, what would he say? He said, O Lord, you did not give us enough evidence. A bit dry. I think I would say, if I had my chance at Pascal's bat, I would say, well, if your reputation, sir, because it appears to be a sir or a lord, is as I understand it to be, it might be that you would look more kindly upon someone who would not pretend to believe in you in the hope of a reward or the fear of a punishment, someone who would rather try and lead an ethical life without that bribe, without that inducement, and that I might in that way perhaps earn the credit of this very dubious character. But you see, even to talk like this is surely to make ourselves realize that no grown-up can really allow themselves to think this way. We are responsible ourselves for how we treat others. We are responsible ourselves for a human solidarity, and we will suffer when those solidarities break down. And we have a great interest as well as a great need to keep human dignity and decency alive for its own sake. Not because we fear heaven, excuse me, not because we fear hell or wish for heaven or desire any of these other sorts of primitive fear or inducement.
May I have a brief response?
Please.
God is in the Abrahamic tradition, and in fact, I think for all the major religions, an immaterial being. And there is something inherently ridiculous in demanding a material proof of an immaterial being. You have to ask, what is the kind of evidence that would convince me? So, for example, gravity is immaterial. Now, not the effects of gravity. If I jump out of a tall tower, I plummet to the ground. But that's me. Gravity is the law describing what I did. Where do we find gravity? We infer it from its effects. So the question is, we have here a universe. It had a beginning. Presumably didn't create itself. Who created it? Or what created it? That what can't be natural. The universe includes everything that all of nature. It has to be non-natural, let us say supernatural. It has to be pretty powerful, maybe not all powerful, but close to it. That we call God. Now, in one of my debates with the atheist Michael Shermer, I told him, I said, what kind of proof would convince you that God exists? What if you found a planet that had emblazoned on it, Yahweh made this? Would you convert on the spot? And he said, no. He said, I can think of no evidence whatever that would convince me. In a sense, I guess what we're getting at here is, there is here, I think, not only, and I think on the part of Russell too, a refusal to believe, but an atheism that has explanations other than simply the absence of evidence. In some senses, Christopher got close to it earlier in this debate where he said, to me, God is a bit like a celestial despot. Heaven is sort of like celestial North Korea. I don't want to stand there handing out garlands for eternity. I don't want to go to that kind of place. So it's not as if God is grabbing the unbeliever and flinging him into hell. God is making heaven available to everyone, and the atheist of his free will is saying, I don't want to go there.
Revealed himself to his people. Today, folks, including Richard Dawkins, ask, why doesn't God just reveal himself again and end the argument about his existence once and for all? Do you think there's any chance he might?
There is a chance he might. I've asked this question often. What is it Woody Allen has said in one of his movies? If just God would sneeze, I would be happy. All I just want is a sneeze, and that would be sufficient. My belief is that if God did some spectacular miracle, the heavens lit up all over the world and in hundreds of languages, clouds formed the words, I am God, you better take care of each other. It would have an impact for approximately 3 days. May, for some people, forever. But immediately there would be explanations of cloud formations that scientists would come up with. It wouldn't matter. That's the brilliance of the story, to my mind, at any rate, in the Bible, and where the Jews are shown all these miracles and then end up building a golden calf anyway. I mean, shortly after, the sea was split, and they still built a golden calf. That is human nature, because we always ask, what did you do for me today? That's the way it is. We are children in many ways, and God is this paternalistic figure. And just as our children don't walk around thinking, my God, you diapered me all those years? Wow. I mean, how many babies say, I've prevented my parents from having intimacy for the last 3 months. I'm going to shut up tonight. It just doesn't happen. The human is not built in with gratitude. And so the same thing with God. It's, what did you do for me lately? So I don't think it would work if God did make some revelation. And finally, I don't think there's anything for God to reveal. There's nothing new to be said. It's been said. There's nothing new to be said. It is our task. There is an instruction manual that I believe in, and if you follow it, generally speaking, people are kinder. And if you don't follow it, or you pervert it, then obviously bad happens. But I don't know, what is God going to add today? What exactly? Don't abuse children? Don't build gas chambers? What hasn't been said? It's been said. It's our task to say either I will live by it or not. But that's my answer to that question.
Actually, there is nothing against child abuse or genocide in the Ten Commandments, since you happen to mention this.
Well, there is. There's do not murder. There is. Murder means the immoral killing of an innocent. So there is, in fact, a prescription.
There's nothing for child abuse and nothing against genocide. Well, genocide is about to be recommended against the Amalekites only a few pages later.
Yes, against the Amalekites. It is one exception because of a horrific evil. It never happened. But that it is prescribed. I have no answer to it, just as I cannot tell you that if God people say, well, what if God told you to sacrifice your child like he
and
told
no
Abraham?
No condemnation of slavery or child abuse.
Okay, God. Well,
but
there
of
is,
coveting,
well,
yes.
Well,
of envy, yes. Well, of ambition, yes.
Okay.
This is obviously man-made, and man-made at a time of Stone Age morality.
Okay.
There's no divine presence or inspiration in it. At all, surely that must be plain.
Oh, well, that is a matter of opinion. My opinion is that the break with everything preceding the Old Testament, specifically the first five books, is so enormous that it you have to either explain its authors as supermen or some divine authorship involved. The notion that there is an invisible God who prefers goodness to evil was unknown in the world. The idea that this life is to be celebrated. Remember, Judaism arose out of Egypt. In Egypt, the Book of the Dead was the Bible. The pyramids were the great works of art, and they were tombs. The Egyptians celebrated death. And it was that Torah coming out of Egypt that said, I have put before you life and death, and you shall choose life. It is an utterly life-centered idea in the midst of a death-centered world. Ironically, Israel is, to this day, 2008, still in a death-centered world.
Question for Mr. Hitchens. You state that you don't want God, or God as you define him, to exist. But what if it turned out that this God, unlike many of his flawed followers, were full of mercy and love towards those who suffer? The God of the prodigal son, be it the parable, the painting, or the book. Would that be a God you could accept?
No, because let me say what I think about the underlay of that question, which is, people try to design the sort of God they would like. This is a part of the religious cafeteria of which I'm so
critical. The God, if he exists, does not owe me an explanation. It would be idle, it seems to me, and trivial to say, well, if you exist, why are you cruel? It's boring and self-pitying to talk like that. Pascal says in his famous wager, well, what have you got to lose? If he does exist, you may find yourself tremendously fortunate if you make the right propitiations and if you agree with his existence. And if he doesn't, well, then you haven't lost a thing. Now, I regard that as another example of the essential immorality of religious preachment. That seems to me a hucksterish thing to be saying on Pascal's part. My reply to it would be, Bertrand Russell's reply to this, by the way, was, if he was confronted with God on the day he died, what would he say? He said, oh Lord, you did not give us enough evidence. A bit dry. I think I would say, if I had my chance at Pascal's bat, I would say, well, if your reputation, sir, because it appears to be a sir or a lord, is as I understand it to be, it might be that you would look more kindly upon someone who would not pretend to believe in you in the hope of a reward or the fear of a punishment, someone who would rather try and lead an ethical life without that bribe, without that inducement, and that I might in that way perhaps earn the credit of this very dubious character. But you see, even to talk like this is surely to make ourselves realize that no grown-up can really allow themselves to think this way. We are responsible ourselves for how we treat others. We are responsible ourselves for a human solidarity, and we will suffer when those solidarities break down. And we have a great interest as well as a great need to keep human dignity and decency alive for its own sake, not because we fear heaven, not because we fear hell or wish for heaven or desire any of these other sorts of primitive fear or inducement.
May I offer a brief response? God is in the Abrahamic tradition, and in fact, I think for all the major religions, an immaterial being. And there is something inherently ridiculous in demanding a material proof of an immaterial being. You have to ask, what is the kind of evidence that would convince me? So, for example, gravity is immaterial. Now, not the effects of gravity. If I jump out of a tall tower, I plummet to the ground. But that's me. Gravity is the law describing what I did. Where do we find gravity? We infer it from its effects. So the question is, we have here a universe. It had a beginning. Presumably didn't create itself. Who created it? Or what created it? That what can't be natural. The universe includes everything that all of nature. It has to be non-natural, let us say supernatural. It has to be pretty powerful, maybe not all-powerful, but close to it, that we call God. Now, in one of my debates with the atheist Michael Shermer, I told him, I said, what kind of proof would convince you that God exists? What if you found a planet that had emblazoned on it, Yahweh made this? Would you convert on the spot? And he said, no. He said, I can think of no evidence whatever that would convince me. In a sense, I guess what we're getting at here is, there is here, I think, not only, and I think on the part of Russell too, a refusal to believe, but an atheism that has explanations other than simply the absence of evidence. In some senses, Christopher got close to it earlier in this debate where he said, to me, God is a bit like a celestial despot. Heaven is sort of like celestial North Korea. I don't want to stand there handing out garlands for eternity. I don't want to go to that kind of place. So it's not as if God is grabbing the unbeliever and flinging him into hell. God is making heaven available to everyone, and the atheist of his free will is saying, I don't want to go there.
Final question for Mr. DeSouza. Let's do one more for Dinesh and one more for Christopher, and then we'll call it a night. Mr. DeSouza, you've written that atheism does not have much to offer in the way of consolation when one is suffering. But I'd like to go back to the basic question of Job. Why does the all-powerful God of the Jewish and the Christian scriptures allow suffering at all? Surely he could have come up with a better way to draw us to him.
This is maybe one of the oldest questions faced by believers. And as you note in the example of Job, the atheists often present the problem as though they invented it. but in fact it's an ancient problem within the orbit of belief. Now look, the problem is only a problem if stated in a narrow way. God is compassionate, we've got suffering and injustice, therefore this God could not exist. Stated that way, the proposition cannot be disputed. But this is a proposition that relies on stating a theist or Christian premise and then refuting it. So you got to state the premise fully. The premise is not God in his compassion created a perfect world, but God is compassionate but also just. God created a universe, but he also created a universe according to law. And that is to say not only moral laws, but physical laws. Now, there is natural evil that results from physical laws. There's a drought, or there is a tsunami, and people are killed. The only way for those to be suspended would be for our universe not to operate according to physical laws, not to live in a lawful universe, which, by the way, would make science impossible. Second, moral evil. We are created with free will. And that means that people can do terrible things. Free will can be used well, or it can be used badly. The alternative for God would be to create automatons, which he didn't. It's not clear that would be a better world. So God didn't do the Holocaust. Hitler and his minions did. I think ultimately, as humans, we will never fully answer these problems, but I think you touched on something very important in the beginning where you said that while theism may not be able to fully explain evil, atheism offers absolutely no psychological or emotional compensation for it. If we face suffering, a mother or I as a father lose a child, I'm less concerned with why did that happen and more with how do I go on? How do I face this level of grief? In that, atheism has nothing to offer. Things happen. Too bad for you. We're all molecules. Get used to it. Religion offers hope. Listen, you lost a loved one, but that loved one is in the arms of God. You might see that loved one again. Call it wishful thinking if you will, but the point is neither of us knows if that's true. The bottom line of it is for the suffering mother, theism offers consolation, and atheism does not.
Thank you. Christopher, final question. Several queries along the same lines of this tonight here. Where does your morality originate? Why aren't the various massacres, holocausts, and genocide simply the process of natural selection? And on a parallel track, why do humans, from your interpretation, appeal to a sense of justice and fairness when, in fact, there are so very few, if any, examples of either in this world?
Did I not just do my stuff about the golden rule? Haven't I just, in fact, I mean, couldn't I have a question I haven't already answered? Or haven't you just answered 2 minutes ago? It seems like a waste of a question to make me go through all that again. In the meantime, I will just add that it's certainly true of religion that it offers consolation.
All right.
Can I then?
It does. It tells you all kinds of consoling things. There's no doubt about that.
You didn't do justice to the question. The question wasn't what do you believe. That's what you answered when you spoke about the golden rule. It asked what the source is.
That's what I was saying.
We want to know your source. Your source seems to be your opinion. Well, what if my opinion is I would like to screw everybody unless they screw me first.
If you like, I'll remind you of what I said. I don't mind reminding you. I said it will not be found that there has ever been a human society where courage and strength and care for others is despised, where savagery, adultery, theft, perjury, and so on are thought of as morally neutral or not to be condemned. I'm sorry, I bore myself when I repeat. I'm very much afraid of boring other people if I do it.
Well, it may bore you, but it doesn't answer the question.
I didn't say this is my opinion.
We still do not have a clue as to where your source is. It's
sir,
your opinion.
I did not say that was my opinion. I said I don't think it will be found that there has ever been.
That's a non sequitur. You won't find a society that didn't have slavery. What's your argument? The ubiquity of a principle does not mean a thing.
Christopher, may I reformulate the question slightly and pose it to you in a way I think you'll find challenging?
More interesting, yes, maybe.
Okay. You said that the golden rule, this idea of reciprocity, this idea, for example, of extending respect to others is universal, and maybe it is. What I want to know is, what is its Darwinian explanation? In other words, I can understand why, as a mother might jump into a burning car to save her two children. They share her genes. She's got a genetic kinship. I can understand why a businessman might treat a customer well. He has a Machiavellian motive. He wants the customer to come back. I scratch your back, you scratch my back. But I don't understand why someone would get up and give their seat to a 75-year-old lady in a bus. I don't think the person doing that is hoping to get her seat next week. Why would you give blood? Why would a soldier die for his country? Why would somebody do something for total genetic strangers? This kind of goodness appears to have no Darwinian explanation. So what is it?
Actually, the Darwinian explanation isn't as bad as you might think. But by the way, Darwin doesn't say that evolution is a form of perfection. Natural selection is not at all a form of it's a very crude form, if you like. Extremely crude form. By pointing out that it exists, we don't recommend it. We don't say it is the source of morality. It says these are the kinds of mammals and primates that you're dealing with. This is how they came to be. It was earlier absurdly suggested by somebody that God wouldn't create people who didn't care about them. Well, how does that work for sheep? How does that work for rats? How does that work for viruses? How did that work for dinosaurs? I think it's entirely thinkable that there could be a prime mover who didn't care about his creation. But I'm digressing from my point about, say, blood donation. Which happens to be my favorite example, and when I was a socialist was my favorite example. How is it that the British National Health Service never runs out of blood and never charges for it either and never pays a donor to give it? How is it that people step forward and say you can have a pint of mine for the general good? Well, one reason, if you want us to not get too moistly idealistic about it, is if you give a pint of blood, you aren't actually a pint short. The beauty of it is you give a pint and someone else gets it, but you haven't lost one, because you'll replenish it after a nice strong cup of tea, which they'll give you in the British National Health Service in the recovery room. So how nice. Someone else is a pint better off and you're not a pint worse off. I can't think of a better way of saying that human solidarity doesn't depend either on self-interest or on self-sacrifice, that it is a rational calculation. And we don't know quite why this is, but it is the case. Quite a lot of people, including those of us who have no belief in any supernatural power or creator, feel better. We benefit in this way. We feel better for having done it. We get pleasure from the thought of helping someone who can't do us a favor. It's called the gift relationship in the great socialist statement by Professor Titmuss about the origins of the blood donor movement. It isn't a reciprocal. It isn't a quid pro quo. It's just in the general interest, and you feel good about having done it. And furthermore, since you have to insist on, and I think rightly, the possibility that there's a rational self-interest involved, I happen to have an extremely rare blood group. And one day I'm going to need some blood. So it is in my interest that the blood banks be properly manned, properly staffed, and regularly replenished. Now, all of that, everything that I've just said, makes perfect sense to everyone, I presume. Not because it's me talking, but because I haven't left anything out, and it's its own explanation and its own justification. And it works without any divine intervention or prompting at all, of any kind.
Perhaps.
Thank you.
Along the same lines, though, at what point do animals share the same sense, do other primates share the same sense of right and wrong as we do, and do they adhere to the golden rule? At what stage is this?
The higher primates do. We're learning much more and more about how apes and pigs and many others have elementary families and kinships and clan. We've been very late in studying this kind of thing. The more we find out, the more moving it is. And it's obviously based upon self-interest and survival. And it is selective for survival and for reproduction and so forth. And I suppose there could be people who would say that also was evidence of a divine design. But then that would somewhat degrade the idea that we, the human mammals, the human primates, are a special creation. And as I say, these are the sorts of problems that don't exist in my world, because I don't invent difficulties of this kind, and I don't have to.
May I offer a very brief thought?
Yes, and that
I do think that as human beings, we do have some unusual qualities that are inexplicable on a strictly Darwinian account. I can fully understand, as evolved creatures, why we would develop a brain to survive, to be able to elude the woolly mammoth, to kill the prey. I don't understand why we've evolved a brain that can understand the rotation of the planets. I don't think that man 5,000 years ago had to figure those things out in order to survive. I don't know why we would have evolved higher mathematics, the love of beauty. The point is not that we feel good when we do good things. The point is, why would that emotion have survived the Darwinian selection? Machiavelli would tell you that it's much better to be bad and appear good. That's the guy who's going to end up on top. The fellow who actually is good is going to come to grief. So why weren't all the virtuous people eliminated from the face of the earth? Because the cunning and the survivors are the ones who got to make the most descendants. The very fact that we live in a universe where all of us live in a dimension of this is the way we act, but there's a little voice that often calls us to act against self-interest. I'm walking on the river bank. I'm not a good swimmer. Somebody shouts out, help, help, I'm drowning. I have every Darwinian imperative to keep walking. But if I do, I know I'm going to feel bad. Some little voice inside of me says, you should have helped that person, even at a risk to your own genes and your own survival. What is the source of that little voice? It seems to have, if you will, a transcendent source. And if you don't want to call it God, you can call it universal morality. But it's within us. It is the empirical datum we're looking for. And it points to something higher than ourselves. Thank you.
While it appears that Dinesh has had the final word, that is illusory because the conversation will continue in the back of the room. It was Flannery O'Connor who said that the truth does not change according to our ability to stomach it. So I would encourage each of you to continue the conversation, sorting out the truth from the sophistry here tonight while meeting the needs of your stomach in the back of the room, where you can purchase signed autographed copies from each of our authors as well as DVDs. I would ask you to allow our three speakers to make the exit a la rock stars that they are, so that they can get to the back of the room instead of trying to snag them along the way. I'm sure they'd be happy to talk to you there, but if they get caught here, we'll never get to the back of the room. So please allow them to exit, get back there, settle down, and I'm sure they'd like to speak to you. Thank you.